Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Understand, defend, and share your faith with confidence. This is Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
Thank you for joining us on Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson, and before we hear from today's guest, just a quick reminder to visit premierunbelievable.com for more shows, articles, and resources. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform. But now for today's show.
Well, I am absolutely delighted today to be joined by Jay Kim, who is the lead pastor at Westgate Church in San Jose, California. He's the author of numerous books, including Analog Church, Analog Christian, Colossians, One Jesus, One People, and his most recent book, Listen, Listen, Speak. Hi, Jay. Thank you so much for joining us.
So fun to be with you, Ruth. Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Well, Jay, there's so many things I want to ask you about, but what I would love is if you would just take us right back to the start of your story. I mean, what was your experience of God growing up?
Yeah, I grew up in the church. I'm an only child, grew up with a single mother who was an immigrant to the United States. So church really became a safe place and home. It was the apparatus of my entire social life. I was quite a lonely kid at school, moved a lot, went to, you know, 7 different schools in 12 years, that kind of thing. So grew up in church and loved it. And then my freshman year of college went through what is sadly now a very common story, sort of a significant deconstruction of my faith. And spent probably 3 years of my life as an agnostic. I think I still believed at the time that there was some divine reality out there, but certainly not all these, you know, stories I was told as a kid about Jesus rising from the dead and all of that nonsense. And then in my early 20s, because of a group of guys who just really poured into me, invested in me, never gave up on me, long story short, came back to Jesus and maybe encountered the risen Christ for the first time in a real way in my life. And that led to leading a little middle school boys small group at my old church. And here we are 20 years later.
Well, I want to dive into some of that a little bit more, some of your doubts, some of the reasons for your deconstruction and then sort of reconstruction. But before we do that, I would just love to know a little bit more about your mom. She just sounds incredible. I mean, I think I read somewhere that she had a pretty radical conversion to Christianity. Mm-hmm. Would you just say a little bit about that and what it was like for you growing up, I suppose, in the wake of all of that?
Yeah, my mother had a really hard life, She had lost both her mother and father by the time she was 12. Her father passed away when she was 7, her mother when she was 12. She was the youngest of 4 children. And then when she was in her late teens and early 20s, her 2 oldest siblings also passed away. So a lot of death, a lot of loss, a ton of grief in her life. And really, I think to this day, she holds a lot of trauma in her body. And so very difficult childhood, difficult young adulthood. She meets my father. They get married. Neither of them are Christian nor religious or anything like that. And then I'm born into this sort of, you know, their marriage was really volatile and chaotic. And then when I was 2, the story goes, when I was 2, my mother literally has this sort of overnight conversion experience. where I won't get into all the details, but she's at the end of her rope. She really, truly is asking existential questions like, is this even worth it? You know, that sort of thing. She's in a very dark place and finds her way in the middle of the night to a church, just a Christian church. Nobody's there, but the doors were open. She goes in and she just starts really sort of, you know, spewing all of her anger out to a God she did not believe was there. And, you know, she starts going through the whole thing like, man, if you're real, then prove it kind of deal. And he does. And she wakes up the next morning from 0 to 100, like this devoted, passionate follower of Jesus, really hungry for more of God in her life. And that has never let up, you know, since then. For the last 40 years, she still to this day, most passionate follower of Jesus that I know. So it's a long, beautiful, profound story, but that's kind of the short of it.
Wow, what an inspiration. Jay, I want to hear just a little bit more about some of the reasons that you began to kind of deconstruct your faith. And I suppose, you know, I know you do a lot of looking at the culture of today. And I guess it's one thing, your story, but what do you think are some of the reasons that people perhaps today either leave the church or maybe aren't even interested in Christianity in the first place? Would you just say a little bit about your own story and about perhaps some of the things that you've kind of learned along the way with the experience that you've seen? I know you're part of the Regeneration Project as well, yeah. Which, you know, you do a lot of work around these areas of trying to answer some of people's questions and things like that.
Right. In my own story, yeah, my faith really started falling apart in college at university because I realized in hindsight, I didn't really have a faith of my own. What I thought was a robust Christian faith was really just a deep commitment to the social structure of friendships that I experienced in, you know, the youth group that I belong to and all of that. And I actually think that's quite common, you know, especially in terms of deconstruction, meaning somebody grows up with a faith and then that faith comes unraveling. You know, that's the difference between the duns and the nuns or whatnot. So, yeah, that's what happened to me. I think that's also quite common. You know, I think another thing I saw even back then, you know, 20 something years ago, and I think has only increased in the last couple of decades in terms of why so many people deconstruct faith, is just utter hypocrisy in the church, and specifically hypocrisy amongst church leaders, you know. So that was a part of my story, actually. The church where I grew up was led by a man that was a hero to me in many ways. But my freshman year of college, he left the church and left his family and ran away with another woman. And I remember thinking to myself, now that story ended really beautifully, actually, in redemption. And he, you know, repented and came back and reconciled with his family and his wife. But I remember when that happened, I just thought I was so shell-shocked and everything came sort of crumbling. Like all of that was a lie. Like the whole thing was a lie this whole time. For years and years, I believed you were one type of person and it was all a lie. So I had attached too much of my faith to, you know, a person rather than to the story of Jesus. So, and I think those are common things we see today, especially with the rise of social media and news media, so many stories of hypocrisy in the church. And yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I guess you, like me, live in a pretty, I guess I'm going to use air quotes here, secular city. Yeah. You know, you live in San Jose, I live in London. Yeah. Statistically, there are not loads of Christians in those places. I mean, have you encountered particular questions or specific objections towards Christianity? Or do you think that people are perhaps sort of not even interested in it, actually really quite apathetic towards Christianity? That's your truth, but it's not my truth. What's your kind of take on all of this?
Yeah, it's all of that, at least where I live. I think the most common sort of response to Christianity and the church is just apathy, at least where I am. There's a sort of, outer external politeness, like, oh, that's nice, you go to church and you do that thing, but it's not for me. You know, good. I'm glad it helps you. I just have no interest. So I see a lot of that. I think that's the overriding theme. And then I would also say those who do have some modicum of, you know, emotional investment, at least in the conversation around Christianity and the church. I do think, you know, maybe 30 years ago, people might have been asking, you know, secular culture may have been asking, is Christianity true? But I don't think that's the primary question secularism is asking anymore. I think the primary question they're asking is Christianity good? You know, and I see a lot of that. And I see a lot of it in my relationships and in just media, you know, and look at what the Christians are doing here and doing there to ruin American democracy or whatever it might be. And so, yeah, I mean, Christianity, at least in some ways, has a significant PR problem, because that is the question people are asking. Like, is this good for our world? Like, are Christians actually good for the world? The answer is yes, but we have to embody that answer, not just scream it from the mountaintops.
Yeah, and I guess this is an absolutely massive question, but how do we engage meaningfully then with people's objections and questions, taking them seriously, but showing that actually there are answers to some of these big questions and some of these huge objections that people have?
Yeah, I don't think this is the question you're asking, but it's the first thing that comes to mind, and it's something I've been thinking about a lot. I would actually respond to that question by saying, we do it locally. Mm-hmm. There's such a temptation because of the internet and the digital age and social media to just scream from our digital devices, you know, and to just tear people down on Twitter or X or Instagram or TikTok or, you know, Reddit or wherever on why they're wrong. But we do that at the expense of leaning into the places and spaces and the people with whom and toward whom we can have actual influence and impact, which is just like our actual local geographic surroundings. That's one of the things that's like so sad to me. We spend so much time online that we fail to lean into the opportunity and the calling, really, I believe, to embody the way of Jesus in real ways amongst real people, you know, that are in our lives. And so that's what I would say, you know, think local, think small, think who is actually literally here that I can, you know, serve and love and reach, rather than what 240 character tweet can I, you know, send out next, sort of thing.
We need to take a short break, but before we get back to the discussion, I want to invite you to take a look at a new unbelievable course. It's called Did It Really Happen? The Birth of Jesus. Perhaps you've been asked questions about the historicity of Jesus, or maybe you have questions of your own. We've made an in-depth course with experts and theologians diving into the historical accuracy and arguments for and against the Jesus birth narratives. You will be guided through all areas of the discussion with N.T. Wright, Emil Ewing, Daryl Bopp, and others. Check it out by visiting premierunbelievable.com/courses.
You're listening to Unapologetic from Premier Unbelievable.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
we're definitely going to delve into a bit more of that digital analog stuff in a later episode, because I think some of the stuff you've said about this is really important and really needs to be heard. But I guess one of the other things that I was thinking about, and it's certainly true in my context, I'm sure, you know, you live in a fairly similar city in terms of context, but whether some people don't engage with Christianity because they perhaps don't think that they will be welcome or they don't feel welcome. And you shared an article, you shared an encounter in an article that I read of yours, where you, as a child in an American school, you were mocked because of a Korean dish that your mum had packed in your lunchbox. Mm-hmm. And firstly, I'm so, so sorry that you encountered that. But I guess it got me thinking, actually, how do we ensure that no one feels excluded from Christianity because of their culture, their ethnicity, their age, their sexuality, their background, you know, insert whatever it is that means that people feel like they might perhaps not be welcome in a Christian space?
God, what a wonderful question. Yeah, I mean, one, we have to remember and capture the vision that the end of the story, the book of Revelation, gives us, that when all of this comes to its beautiful culminating end, which is really the beginning of the age to come, when Christ returns and redeems and restores and renews the world and heaven and earth, you know, collide and God's space becomes human space. When all of those things happen and we read about it in the book of Revelation, John's great vision of where the story is headed, we have to remember and celebrate and embrace and look forward to the reality that on that day and in the age to come, there are people of every tribe, nation, and tongue, this like beautiful diversity of God's people. And we have to capture that vision and we have to learn to embody that vision now, you know, imperfectly, but as best as we can, to be a people of the future. You know, I think the church should be the most diverse place on the planet. And some churches are, most are not. You know, we're still quite homogenous on a number of levels. So that's one thing I would say. We have to capture that vision and just remind ourselves always that is where the story is headed. And we are a people of the future. We can choose to embody that future reality now. And two, more pragmatically, I think a part of what it means is that we learn to live with a humility and a curiosity about one another. In the digital age and in the information age, when, you know, with a push of a few buttons on my phone, I can get whatever information I need in a matter of seconds. I think one of the great losses of our age is curiosity. We're no longer curious. But you cannot get an adequate read on somebody's actual personal story on Wikipedia or the internet. That's the information about their story, but stories are much more than information. So again, I think the way forward is to recapture and constantly remind ourselves of the vision of God's kingdom in the age to come, and to live with humility and curiosity as an ongoing posture toward people around us.
You mentioned that the question that people really care about is whether Christianity is good rather than necessarily whether it is true. So it might be that this question is perhaps not as applicable, but do you think that Christianity is still relevant today? And I guess even bigger than that question, like, does it matter? Should we be seeking to be relevant? Or has the church always been and should be actually so vastly different that actually we're not relevant?
Oh gosh, what a wonderful question. I would respond yes and no. Yes, the church should be relevant in the sense that the church should do the work of bridging the gap between abstract ideas and lived experiences. So just waxing poetic in a 45-minute sermon about all, you know, big, heady theological ideas and words and whatever, that's grossly irrelevant to a real person's life. So in that sense, of course, like, and it's not just the sermon, it's everything we do needs to relate to real lived experiences. Absolutely. But in the more sort of normative usage of that word culturally today, relevant, meaning like, oh, am I outdated? Are we weird? Are we sort of like not totally part of the normative? Along those lines, I would say the red, and I've written about this, you know, the red hot pursuit of relevance is, it's actually counterproductive, you know, and I could talk about this for a long time. I'll just leave it here. Christianity has always been weird. Like, it has always been weird. It's weird. It's a strange movement. And, you know, like, we are instructed to eat the body and drink the blood of our Savior, who was a Jewish rabbi and carpenter who lived and died and rose again and ascended into the kingdom of God. Like, that is weird. And at the same time, I think it is the stuff that is so beyond normal, the stuff that breaks expectations, that's the transcendent stuff that really captures imaginations and hearts and lives. So I do think we have to recapture some of that weirdness.
And I guess one thing that really grates in, I suppose, whatever you want to call it, a relativistic culture, the idea that Jesus is the way, the truth, the life, really sort of goes against the grain, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pluralism or tolerance is all the rage, you know, and it is offensive. The way of Jesus is offensive. I mean, you see it in the gospel stories. Jesus is constantly offending people. Not because he's rude. He's like the most kind, loving, gentle, humble, meek, you know, lowly savior one could imagine. But he's offensive because what he says about himself is offensive, that there is no other way to God the Father but him. You know, John 14, that he is the way, the truth, and the life, that no one gets to God except through Christ. And again, I think we have to embrace the reality that that is weird and maybe even a little bit offensive. We shouldn't be offensive. Like, our posture should be one of warmth and humility and kindness and gentleness, all the fruit of the Spirit stuff that Paul writes about in Galatians 5. But the way of Jesus is by its nature quite countercultural to the way of pluralism and tolerance and on and on. And I think it's important that we embrace that reality and lean into it.
You very kindly shared your own experience of doubt and deconstruction before you reconstructed, I guess, for want of a better word. But what advice would you give someone who's kind of in the throes of where you were in your college years, in those 3 years of agnosticism, where they're just doubting everything and they don't know if any of it's true, they don't know if God is good, they don't know if he's real? Is there any advice that you would give someone in that situation, in the midst of their doubts?
Yeah, several thoughts come to mind. It's a wonderful question. The first thing I would say is doubt is not death. Right? Doubting does not mean that your faith has died. Doubting, not always, but doubting often means that your faith is actually coming alive in ways that it was not before. That was true in my experience. It's been true in the experience of many friends of mine who have gone through significant seasons of deconstruction and found faith again in a rich, robust way. So doubt is not death. God is not angry at you. Now, you may not even believe there is a God, but if there is one, the God I have discovered to be true, he is not angry at you that you doubt. In fact, you know, at the end of Matthew's gospel, after Jesus' resurrection, right before his ascension, he gives the Great Commission, you know, that most people know, like, go and make disciples. And he says this to these 11 young men. But what's so interesting is right before he gives the Great Commission to all of them, Matthew, Jesus's biographer, tells us that they all gathered and they saw the risen Christ. And he says, some doubted. Like, some of them were not sure. And Jesus doesn't say, hey, the 8 of you who have no doubts, completely certain, you go and make disciples. The 3 of you just relax, sit on the sidelines till you get over your doubt. That's not what he says. He says to all of them, including the ones who were doubting, go and make disciples. So I would say Jesus is closer to you than you think. He has deep love for you in the midst of your doubt and deconstruction. And the last thing I would say is deconstruct in such a way that you have enough in the rubble of your deconstruction to reconstruct. Deconstruction without reconstruction just leaves your life in shambles, in ruins. You know, the more important work will be to begin slowly reconstructing whatever it is you reconstruct, to begin reconstructing at some point.
That's really helpful. You wrote an article for the Gospel Coalition where you were sort of giving advice to people coming alongside people who were doubting. And you talked about just being patient and going slow and inviting the person to go slow with you. And I think so often we rush into all of this stuff, don't we? So I was really struck by that. Jay, just as we come to the end of this episode, I would really love to know, having encountered doubt and deconstruction yourself, what would you now say if someone asked you why you personally believe in God? I guess I'm kind of asking you for your like 1 minute elevator pitch, if you if you will.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I would say I lived a life without God and came to the conclusion that even if he is not real, the imagined possibility of him framed the world in a way that made sense, in ways that a godless life just could never offer. So I got to the place where I realized, you know, I think I would rather live under the lie that there is a God who loves me than in the truth that there isn't. And then my next step forward was the incredible discovery through community, men and women, like real people I could not deny, who embodied this God of love in a way that made that God of love undeniable to me. And that changed everything. That this sort of imagined reality was actually real. And that's what brought me to a place where I knew I had to give the rest of my life to helping people go on that journey.
Thank you for listening to Unapologetic. I'm Ruth Jackson. And as always, you can find out more about our guests through the links with today's show. We would love to hear your feedback. Do drop us an email with your thoughts at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via social media. And don't forget, there are more shows, articles and resources at our website, premierunbelievable.com. You can also register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you enjoy listening to Unapologetic, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
You've been listening to Unapologetic. For more shows, resources and our newsletter, visit premierunbelievable.com.